All right, this morning I want to talk to you about the origin of the universe. I want to take a look at the two models, to briefly summarize them. And then after summarizing the two models, I want to take a look at the assumptions that are always involved in studying the history of the universe. And then I want to take a good look at the Big Bang hypothesis and the steady state hypothesis, which are the two major naturalistic hypotheses for explaining things. Now, you need to keep in mind that any time you talk about the past history of things, you're talking on the basis of an extrapolation into the past. There's no way to study the past directly, you see. Science is very limited by having to do with observations that we make. We study the motion of objects by the amount of light that's coming from them. All the observations that we make perhaps took place in the past regarding astronomical objects, but nonetheless, when you work back into the past, you have to extrapolate some, you have to make some guesses, and extrapolations can be very dangerous. For instance, if you were to extrapolate your growth rate into the past and into the future, human beings would look rather strange, wouldn't they? If you go back at the time that a person is growing, you know, the period of time that he really grows quite a great deal, and if you were to plot his height, say, versus time, oh, say starting at about 5 or 6 years old and going up through a number of years, and you were to plot his height versus the time or his age, and you were to try to extrapolate that growth rate that you could get from that curve back into the past and into the future, things might turn out rather strangely, isn't that right? Just to pick a number, suppose he grows a half a foot a year for a while. Just to pick some kind of number, I haven't the slightest idea, without thinking about it, what the growth rate would be. But if you picked a number like that, and you projected that too far into the future, you would have a person that was literally a giant, isn't that right? And if he kept on growing until the time that he died, then you would have a person of tremendous, colossal size. And then if you worked backward into the past, to try to extrapolate to find what his size would be, let's say at time t equal to zero, there you'd have a rather strange size, isn't that right? And suppose you went into the negative numbers so far as time is concerned. What kind of size would you assign then? Extrapolations are dangerous if you don't have some observations to give you a real hunch as to how things are changing. So one must be very careful when they extrapolate. Well, since we had no observations regarding the beginning of things, since we had no way of saying directly from observing stars or observing processes to take place, how things actually originated, then we have to extrapolate continually. We have to make guesses about things. This puts cosmology, the study of the structure of the universe, and cosmogony, the study of the origin of the universe, on a rather shaky basis. You see, it puts it in the realm of metaphysics, puts it in the realm of philosophy, it puts it in the realm of religion, and of course cosmologists have all sorts of different views. Some have the Christian viewpoint, the creationist viewpoint, regarding things. Others take an atheistic view. Harlow Shapley, in one of his essays that he wrote for a little book called Essays in Earth Studies, he said some people very piously record in the beginning God. He said, I say in the beginning hydrogen. If we have enough hydrogen and we have the physical laws, such as the law of gravity, the conservation laws dealing with energy and momentum, the various physical laws, Newton's three laws of motion, and so forth, he said we can explain this universe in all its detail, and we can do away with myths and fables that have tried to explain this universe on the basis of a god or gods. And he says things have taken a new turn. So his view is certainly one that's very typical of many astronomers and many scientists. And then there are other scientists who hold the creationist position, and they say that you cannot explain this universe on the basis of collapse of a hydrogen cloud or the explosion of a huge primeval atom that was very dense in nature. And they say that you cannot explain order in this universe on the basis of just the physical processes that are occurring, because these physical processes are processes that cause a deterioration of things, a degeneration of things, a wearing out of things, a running down of things. These people maintain that there is no way, on the basis of the physical laws that we know, and having hydrogen, say, plenty of hydrogen, to explain stars. As a matter of fact, it's easier to say why you shouldn't have stars if you look at it just on the basis of the physical laws. It's easier to say why you shouldn't have stars than why you have stars. I think it was Jeffrey Burbage, out at the University of California, San Diego, La Jolla, who said that if you look at the physical laws, there's no way that you can get a star. But he says, since we have stars, and we know they could not have been created, that explanation cannot be true. He says there must be a physical explanation as to why you have stars. But you have two basic models. One, you see, says that the universe is not self-contained, was created, that matter and energy was created, an order within this system was created, and that the system could not give rise to itself, that there had to be an agent or a being outside the system, in the first place to make the system, and the second place to create order within the system, and that it appears that the system is running down now, losing form and body. The other model says, no, the universe essentially is eternal. It had no beginning, really. Some people seem to think that the Big Bang hypothesis says there was a beginning. It was just one of several beginnings in that scheme of things. And if you believe the steady state hypothesis, certainly you would say there was no beginning. But these people would say that the universe can explain itself. It is self-contained. If you have enough matter and energy, you can explain galaxies, you can explain stars, you can explain planetary systems, you can explain everything that you see around you. And Shapley said you could explain it in the detail that you find in the universe. Well, these are the two basic positions. They're contradictory to each other. I don't see hardly how you can harmonize the two positions at all. They seem to say opposite things. And what I'd like to do this morning is take the two naturalistic explanations, the Big Bang hypothesis and the steady state hypothesis, and see if they really explain anything in all of this. It's maintained that they explain everything. An astronomer by the name of Harrison at the University of Massachusetts said that cosmology today should be called the grin cosmology. He said cosmology today is like a Cheshire cat that's grinning. Cheshire cat has a grin on it. And he said, when you look at the Big Bang hypothesis or you look at the steady state hypothesis, it cannot explain the existence of galaxies, where they came from. And he says, these cosmologies or cosmogonies, and the two terms are used practically synonymously today, cannot explain stars, and the cosmologies cannot explain the planets that encircle the sun and travel around the sun. The cosmologies cannot explain the different kinds of stars that you have. He said these cosmologies are like a Cheshire cat that's missing its tail, missing its ears, missing its head practically, missing its body, and all that's left is the grin. And he says it is the grin cosmology, can explain just a thing or two perhaps, and all of the rest is missing. And he says these things should be called the grin cosmologies, because they really explain practically nothing. They say they explain a lot, but explain practically nothing, and certainly do not explain any of the details of all of this. And I think he is exactly right in this contention. So, let's take a look. Let's take a look at what they say and see if they actually explain very much. Now, the Big Bang hypothesis, which is probably the one that is in the center stage today, the steady state hypothesis has been losing ground for quite a long time now, ever since Fred Hoyle made his public statement that his ideas were in trouble when he left Cambridge University and went down to Australia. Ever since those days, the steady state hypothesis has been having a lot of trouble, and today there's just a small number of adherents. There's a rather large public that believes in it. All right, I'll try to get the volume up some more. I'm not used to calling Junior when I lecture, but all right, you folks can edit that out. All right, the Big Bang hypothesis says once upon a time there was a huge primeval atom. Some people say that this atom was very, very small in size, about the size of the solar system. Very, very dense, however. All of the matter and energy in the universe was concentrated in that little primeval atom. Other people, like the man who popularized the Big Bang hypothesis, George Gamow, says this primeval atom was infinite in size. Now, supposedly the primeval atom sat around for quite a long time, because the universe supposedly is infinitely old. The length of time since the last explosion of the primeval atom being about 10 to 20 billion years in this scheme of things, this primeval atom sat around for quite a long time, and then suddenly something began to happen in it, and it exploded. Some instability occurred in this primeval atom. The thing exploded, and the chunks of matter and energy began to spread out all over space. When I said chunks of matter and energy, these people maintained that the energy was mainly in the form of radiation, and that the atoms that make up the elements that compose the universe were formed in the very early part of that explosion. In a very small fraction of a second, these elements were formed, the atoms were formed, and later on molecules and so forth, and the universe itself eventually came into existence. Well, this matter and energy spread out all over. You had a great deal of radiation, you had a great deal of matter formed in the early part of the explosion. The whole thing began to spread apart. Eventually, stars were formed, and with stars, galaxies were formed at the same time. Now, there are a number of difficulties in that position. You want to remember this when you think about the whole problem. The idea that the universe was expanding has not always been around. And there's a great deal of question today as to whether it really is expanding or not. Hubble, back in around 1919 or 1920, observed that galaxies have redshifts. In other words, the light coming from these galaxies was shifted to the red side, which means that, you see, if you have an object that is emitting energy or radiation or light and is moving away from you, at the same time that you're watching it, the light, the wavelengths get stretched out. And when they get stretched out, the light is shifted to what's called the red side. You see, the wavelength of the light determines the color of the light. And when the light is shifted to the red side, or stretched out, shifted to the red side, the galaxies appear to be red in color. And Hubble maintained that the galaxies looked red to him. And this seems to be the case, certainly. And so Hubble didn't try to put any interpretation on what was happening to those galaxies. He just said the light coming from those distant galaxies are red-shifted. And it was later on other men that said this represents an expansion of the universe. Everything is spreading apart. As we look at galaxies in all different directions from us, the light appears to be red in color. And so the natural interpretation was that the universe is spreading apart. Now, today, there's more to this problem than meets the eye. A lot of people are claiming that the redshifts don't represent an expansion effect at all, or a motion effect, or a Doppler shift of the light. Some people are saying that it represents different things. And I should mention this to you, because the idea of the universe is expanding is not so cut and dried as it was back in those days. Some people say that light gets tired as it travels over very, very great distances. Of course, when people say the light is tired, that means they really haven't the slightest idea of what is happening to the light. It's just sort of a catch-all. They don't like the idea that the universe is expanding out from some so-called common point where it might have started at some time in the past, and they just lump everything together and say that the light gets tired. It travels over very, very great distances, and they say having to travel over such great distances, energy sort of leaks out of the tires, so to speak, you see, as it covers great distances, and by the time the light gets from a distant galaxy to an observer, you've lost a lot of energy, and as you lose energy, the light becomes reddened because the frequency of the light changes, and it looks red. But that's sort of a catch-all, because nobody has been able to prove that as light travels through a vacuum over great distances, that there's any change in the energy at all that the light is carrying. Well, maybe it's true. Who knows? It's hard to say. But the tired light idea has been around a long time. Some people say that gravitational effects of massive stars on light causes a red shift of the light. And this seems to be somewhat established. But whether it could produce all of these red shifts that have been observed is something that's an entirely different matter. There are a number of different explanations. Some say there are photon-photon interactions that cause a reddening of the light. Others say that neutrinos affect the light and cause it to be reddened. But anyhow, there are a number of different attempts today to explain the redshift of the light on an entirely different basis than an expansion effect, because the expansion idea has its troubles. For instance, different parts of the sun have different redshifts, even after you've corrected for the rotation of the sun. If you look at one portion of the sun, you get a redshift of the light. If you take a look at a different portion of the sun, you get a still different redshift of the light. And it's hard to understand why you should have different redshifts, you see, for light coming out of the same object if it is purely a Doppler effect or a motion effect of either the object approaching you or receding from you. And then galaxies that are physically connected or physically attached, let's say gravitationally or through some means or other, a number of these galaxies have different redshifts when they ought to have the same redshift. After you correct for their rotation and their different motions, they have different redshifts. So the redshift idea, due to expansion, has its difficulties, and this has given rise to a number of ideas to try to explain these redshifts on a basis other than an expansion effect itself. Probably the most famous and the most prominent of the recent ideas as to what could cause a redshift other than expansion is one put forth by the French astrophysicist, Pecker, who says that photons have a mass that is slightly different from zero. And he says they have velocities that are, some of them, less than the velocity of light in a vacuum. In other words, they're not all traveling at 186,000 miles per second in a vacuum. He says they have a whole range of velocities. Now, as there have been a number of opponents to the ideas of relativity, there's been more and more talk that photons can move at velocities that are less than that so-called limiting velocity of 186,000 miles per second. And so Pecker is claiming that photons have masses that are slightly different from zero, that they have a whole range of velocities up to 186,000 miles per second, and that as they come out of stars with different velocities, they collide with each other. And as they collide with each other, they collide in what is called an inelastic fashion, in which energy is dissipated, energy is lost by these photons, and the light is reddened. And he's saying you have different temperatures existing in the sun. You have different concentrations of these photons. The photons are coming out of the sun with different velocities, and as they collide, they lose energy. They collide inelastically, and the light is reddened. And he's saying the effect of a redshift in light is not necessarily a Doppler effect at all, but may be due to inelastic collisions of photons. Well, the idea is very attractive, and it remains to be seen whether it is true or not. He's proposed an experiment. He says put a laser beam along a particular path, put a gamma ray beam along the same path, and you know, if you know the frequency of the light coming out of your source at the start, look at it when it gets down at the end of this path and see if it has the same frequency. If it doesn't, then you must have had collisions involved between your particles in the laser beam and in the gamma ray beam, which would give proof to Pecker's contention. But it still remains to be seen whether what the results of such an experiment will be. As far as I know, it's never been performed yet, but certainly a lot of people are anxious to find out what happens in that case, because this could perhaps settle some of these questions about redshifts and what they really represent. Well, the Big Bang supposedly can explain the redshift of light, but if it is not a Doppler effect, then of course the Big Bang is not really an explanation for that at all. Now, if you look around the sky in different directions, you find that you have sort of a background radiation. You have radiation at a very low temperature that comes from all different directions. And suppose if you have the explosion of a primeval atom, you could get a lot of radiation. The radiation would be dissipated as time goes by. And suppose that the Big Bang can explain this. Well, so far as explanations are concerned, the Big Bang can explain only two things: an expansion effect and the presence of this background radiation. These are the only two things that the Big Bang hypothesis or the Big Bang model can explain. But it has basic difficulties itself. Let me mention some of those while we're at it. Then we'll take that steady state hypothesis second and look at it. In the first place, to me at least, it seems hard to understand how an explosion can produce an ordered arrangement. Now, the Big Bang represents an explosion that occurred 10 to 20 billion years ago in the evolutionary framework for things. In common experience, do we ever see explosions producing ordered arrangements of things? If you wanted to construct a building, do you set off an explosion somewhere? Well, no, or at least we never observe anybody trying it that way. If I told you down on the campus where I teach at the University of Texas at El Paso, that we put up a new, we're building a new coliseum for them to play basketball in down there. If I told you that the contractor charged us $2 or $3 million for it, but all he did was go out and set out an explosion in the andesite rock there near the campus, and already we have that field house constructed after he set off the explosion, you wouldn't believe that for a minute, would you? Or if you would, you're terribly gullible, and you're Missourians to boot. How about that? Be terribly gullible bunch of Missourians here. But the Big Bang people are saying by an explosion, you can produce an ordered arrangement as complicated as a galaxy. A galaxy is very complicated. It consists of stars. It consists of clouds of dust. It consists of objects that are moving in highly ordered orbits. It consists of objects that possess tremendous amounts of energy, possess very complicated magnetic fields. The galaxies themselves possess magnetic fields of their own. The stars possess magnetic fields. And in the Milky Way galaxy, there is a star called the Sun that possesses a solar system or a planetary system. Galaxies are highly complicated. And these people are saying by an explosion, you produce an ordered arrangement. If you set off an explosion, you destroy things, don't you? People drop bombs on buildings to destroy buildings. People set off explosions in the ground to dig out rock or to get seismic waves generated in those rocks or to produce craters or to dig out pits for mining. This is what you use explosions for, isn't that right? To destroy order. Nobody in our common experience, at least, set off explosions to produce ordered arrangements. I wonder if anybody, if there had not been the observation of this redshift, if anybody would have ever proposed an explosion to produce an ordered arrangement of things, or to produce a universe. An explosion is an ordered, destroying process. I think the Big Bang hypothesis, then, has a basic difficulty just from common experience, which is what a scientist goes by, you know, in talking about things. He goes from common experience. He looks at things happening around him. He makes observations about those things that are happening. He tries to describe in some manner or other those happenings. And then, on the basis of that experience, he tries to talk about other things. Well, in common experience, explosions are order-destroying processes. I think the Big Bang hypothesis, then, is off to a bad start because it destroys order, does not produce order, does not build order, cannot in itself give rise to ordered arrangements. Now, this difficulty was originally faced by the man who, by the way, proposed the Big Bang hypothesis to start with. He was the Belgian abbot, Lemaître. Lemaître, by the way, George Gamow gets most of the credit for the Big Bang hypothesis. He popularized it and did a lot of theoretical work after it had been mentioned, but Lemaître was the man who proposed it. Lemaître said there was nothing but space for a while, and suddenly, so to speak, in the twinkling of an eye, with the snap of a finger, an atom came into existence. And this atom was that very dense one that I've already mentioned. And he says the thing exploded, and everything began to spread apart. Lemaître said there is one difficulty with his idea, though. He says that if everything is spreading apart at a tremendously high velocity, at such a high velocity, he said, it would seem that you could never bring any of this matter together. He said, and he was talking about his own model in this case, he said, how do we ever get it to form a star? You know, if everything, here you have atoms and energy that are moving apart with tremendously large velocities, how do we ever get it together to form a star in the first place? How do we ever get a small nucleus, you see, of particles together in a large enough quantity that you can have a star formed or a star produced in all of this? Lemaître said it's impossible. And, of course, he was exactly right. At the velocities at which this matter moves apart that these people were talking about, there's no way in the world to get any of this matter to come together, you see, and to form these objects. So here's what Lemaître said. He said, all right, every matter pulls on itself. Gravity will put the brakes on this expansion and bring this expanding cloud or fragments of material, atoms and so forth, and radiation to a stop. The whole thing will come to a stop. Then, you see, you can get the particles together, matter will contract, and you can form stars and galaxies, you see, at the same time. Well, that's doubtful in the first place, because according to what he said, it was moving apart at such a high velocity that gravity couldn't put the brakes on, you know, enough to bring it to a stop. So the first question was that, how in the world, even with gravity acting, did you get the thing slowed down enough? But suppose he did. Now, the thing is still expanding, supposedly. How do you get it started back up, you see, if it's come to a stop? Suppose you get it all stopped, you see, and your stars formed and your galaxies formed. Then how does the whole thing start moving again? If it, you know, reached some sort of a state of equilibrium, came to a stop, and those kernel and nuclei of matter, you see, form stars and galaxies, and there she was sitting. How do you ever get the thing started back up then, you see, expanding and moving apart? Well, Lemaître said, Lemaître knew this too, he said the whole thing just started back up. Lemaître really didn't give any reason. He said it just started back up. Well, you see, the explosion in the first place was to get the expansion. But you don't want an explosion a second time because you destroy, you see, what you formed there when you had to put the brakes on with the gravity, got the thing to stop, and, you know, got those stars formed and those galaxies formed, and then the whole thing started right back up. You can't have a second explosion or it's goodbye, Charlie, you know, for all those stars and galaxies that you got, that you had the thing stopped for. So Lemaître said, and I saw his statement in his papers, he said it just started back up, started expanding again. Well, this is the beginning of the woe, so to speak, for a lot of this. If it has stopped and is in somewhat of a state of equilibrium, whether it is stable equilibrium or unstable equilibrium, it's going to stay like that, according to Newton's first law of motion, unless there is something external to it, you see, to start it back up. A system of its own accord in a state of equilibrium will not move itself around, will not break that state of equilibrium. According to Newton's first law of motion, it takes something outside the system in order to get it out of that state of equilibrium. When you get up for the morning, I had a hard time getting up this morning on this central time, but anyhow, when you get up for the morning and you're sitting on the edge of the bed and you put your boots on, say, do you reach down the bootstraps and start pulling on them? If you do, you'll be sitting there on the bed this time tomorrow, isn't that right? Or a week from now, if you just keep pulling on your bootstraps, you know, trying to lift yourself, what do? You push against the floor, or else you push against the mattress somewhere or other, isn't that right? You exert a force on something that is external to you, and that, according to Newton's third law of motion, that external object exerts a force on you, and it is the force exerted on you that causes you to get off the bed, isn't that right? You push against the floor, and the floor pushes against you, and off you come, without too much difficulty, perhaps. But it takes a force exerted externally by an object or a being or something outside that system in order to produce some kind of motion. Otherwise, the thing will sit right there in a state of equilibrium. Well, these people can't have it in a state of equilibrium. They can't bring it to a stop and put it in the condition of equilibrium, and then if it's on accord, get it started back up again, you see. You can't have it both ways. You can't have it in equilibrium and have it in non-equilibrium at the same time. It's got to be one or the other. If it's in equilibrium, it's going to sit there. If at all you can believe the laws of physics, it's just going to sit there then, and that's it. And if it's not in a state of equilibrium and things still going, you can't at all have the formation of these stars and galaxies that Lemaître wants, you see, by bringing this thing to a screeching halt and causing it to stop. Well, Lemaître said it just started back up, and here it is now expanding, just like we see it today. Well, the Big Bang hypothesis really, as Margaret Burbidge, the wife of the Jeffrey Burbidge that I mentioned just a little while ago, as she once remarked, she's a follower of Fred Hoyle in his steady state hypothesis. She said correctly in an article in Nature that the Big Bang hypothesis really can't explain anything except the presence of the background radiation, which you could explain on an entirely different basis, for that matter. It can explain the expansion, but all it can explain the expansion of is what? Radiation. And maybe if you can say you got some atoms out of that explosion, some little atoms out of that explosion, but it cannot explain the presence of stars and galaxies and a planetary system and comets and the different star clusters and clusters of galaxies and so forth that we see in our universe. It cannot explain any of the details, as Harrison mentioned. It can explain possibly two different things that are happening. But you see, merely being able to explain an expansion does not mean that you can explain the expansion of stars, stars moving apart, and galaxies moving apart. That's an entirely different matter in the whole question. So the Big Bang hypothesis cannot explain anything, really, except that background radiation and expansion of particles and expansion of radiation, radiation moving apart, a Doppler shift to it, a red shift. And as I've remarked, you can explain an expansion and you can explain the Doppler shifting or the red shifting of the light, the radiation, really on different bases, it seems today, or at least there's work in that direction. and things are not at all cut and dried and settled in this regard. You have difficulties, though, with the Big Bang in that you cannot explain the presence of ordered systems or arrangements of matter. You cannot explain how you could form those in the first place because the expansion would be too rapid and you could not even get a formation of these things. You could not get the instabilities that these people say that you need in order to form stars and galaxies. You know there is a law in physics, there are two basic laws, the first law of thermodynamics and the second law of thermodynamics. First law of thermodynamics is just the old conservation of energy law, which says that matter plus energy, the total amount that you have in a system, remains constant. Supposedly matter plus energy in the universe is a constant. There have been some challenge as to whether matter plus energy is the way that thing ought to be phrased. Some people say it should be phrased, total amount of energy is conserved, total amount of matter is conserved. And there's a great deal of argument today about whether matter and energy really are equivalent. But anyhow, if you take the view that E equals mc squared does represent an equivalent of mass and energy, then the conservation of energy law, the first law of thermodynamics, says the total amount of matter plus energy in the universe is a constant. Now, it's rather difficult to prove that, you understand, because it's hard to take a look at the universe as a whole and say that the total amount in it is conserved. But on a small scale, you know, if you look at things happening here on the Earth and you consider the energy that's involved in some experiment, then it seems that that law is very well verified. And physicists certainly like it because it's an excellent bookkeeping device. It helps you to work a lot of hard problems that would be very difficult to work other ways. Mathematicians believe it's true because they think that physicists have proved it. Philosophers think that it's true because it sounds good. But physicists really use it because it's a very good bookkeeping device. If something starts out with a certain amount of energy, it's got to have that, you've got to be able to account for all of that energy, you see, right down the line. If I hold my watch here and were to drop it, it possesses potential energy in this position, ability to do work, you see, because of its position. If I drop it, it begins to move, of course, under the influence of gravity, and it could do work because of its motion. It's said to possess kinetic energy. If it hits the floor down there, there's a sound wave set up, the floor gets depressed slightly, and so there's some energy expended, you see, in the form of elastic potential energy into the floor, and so forth. And the floor might get heated up, and the air in the room get heated up a little bit by dropping the watch. But supposedly, the amount of energy that the watch started with must be accounted for all the way through its path and wherever it ends up. If you have a truck with a load of bricks on the back of it moving down the freeway, and a brick falls off the back of that truck, it possesses a certain amount of energy when it falls off the back of the truck, isn't that right? When it hits the pavement, it breaks up into pieces, and the energy that the pieces possess must be, and of course the pavement possesses, and the air possesses, and so forth, must be the amount of energy that the brick started with. Energy plus matter must be conserved. But how do you get an ordered arrangement, you see, without something outside your system, if things go from complex to simple, or from order to disorder, naturally or spontaneously? Herbert Dingell, in 1954, when he was president of the Royal Astronomical Society, in his presidential address, he leveled a set of very serious charges against Fred Hoyle and the followers of the Big Bang, I mean the steady-state hypothesis. He accused Fred Hoyle of taking his own mathematics too seriously. He didn't mention Hoyle by name, but the whole paper dealt with Hoyle and his gang. He said, these people work with matrices, believing the ideas of relativity. And he said, because an equation or a matrix predicts certain results, they think this is what the universe must be like. He said, Hoyle has imposed his own mathematical equations on the universe. He says he has imposed his own philosophy on the universe, and he insists that he is right. He says these men are very brilliant mathematicians, and he says they believe that a mathematical equation says what the universe is like, forgetting about making any observations about the universe and drawing conclusions that way before you try to talk about a model for it. He says these people are followers of Aristotle. He says they have already decided what the universe is like. They make their equations say certain things, and then they insist it must be correct because the equation comes out with such and such answer. Well, you can make it come out with such and such answer if you build it in a certain fashion. And he said Hoyle is guilty of imposing his own philosophy on the universe. His own view of what the universe is like. He says he is very much guilty of this. It is amazing that a paper, a presidential address such as the one that Herbert Dingell gave, got so little attention. But Hoyle went on and on. It was not until the discovery of these quasars that Hoyle and the background radiation that Hoyle's ideas really suffered a death blow. And Hoyle himself gave up the idea. He's very angry. He had been having a conflict with Ryle, a radio astronomer at Cambridge University. He was very angry. He left Cambridge, went to Australia. Apparently it wasn't very suitable down there. Came back to Cambridge recently. And when he came back, he was loaded with a new idea. He and a former graduate student of his by the name of Nordekar. And today they've got they have a new steady state. This one has the Big Bang somehow in it, has everything in it. And there's a new version today, which we'll be hearing a lot about as the years go on. Well, what I'm saying is this. The two major hypotheses seem to be violations of the basic laws. Now, if we say we're going to explain things on the basis of the rules that we see around us, we have to follow those faithfully. If you try to go by those rules, you cannot explain the beginning of the thing. You cannot explain the beginning of the universe. It is a discontinuity. It is a singularity. And if the second law of thermodynamics has any meaning at all, it is a singularity that involves a being or an agent outside of all this. The universe cannot be self-contained. So on the basis of science itself, you cannot explain this universe. You can talk about what is happening before you, the running down of things, but you cannot work backwards. You come to an iron curtain, so to speak. You cannot work backwards and say how things occurred or how they started. No matter how you try, you do reach a singularity or a discontinuity in things. So I think I'll say once again, I think Harrison was exactly right about the Cheshire Cat. All right. Have I gone past the time, or is there still time for questions? What time? All right. If you want to ask some questions, yes. Well, because of the peculiar distribution of them in space, you see, they put out tremendous amounts of energy, and people are having a hard time deciding, since the redshifts of those objects are so large, whether they're moving with tremendously large velocities or whether they're in close with putting out large amounts, regardless of where they are, far away or close, they're putting out tremendous amounts of energy. But the distribution of these quasars is the thing that Hoyle went by that cosmological principle, the cosmological assumption, that first one. And the distribution of these quasars in space refute that particular position. So this is where the trouble is with the quasars.
Could you comment on Riemannian time and space?
All right, he says, could I comment on Riemannian time and space? I presume you're talking about the way light travels in space. Well, yeah, I can make a few comments on it. They're speculative, you understand. Nobody knows what space is like. You see, the old idea is that space is Euclidean, straight line space, because we're used to what? Things looking like the shortest distance between two points, straight line, and that sort of viewpoint of things. With the advent of the ideas of relativity from Einstein, there was talk that space was curved. And, of course, the question has arisen quite a great deal as to whether space is curved or not. Most astronomers believe that space is curved and not Euclidean. There's a great deal of argument about it because it's very difficult to decide. There are attempts today to decide whether space is curved or Euclidean, straight-line space, on the basis of the distribution of the galaxies. But there's no clear-cut decision at the present time. Space may be curved, and it may not be curved. It's difficult to prove it one way or the other what space is like. It's just as uncertain one way. There's no clear-cut answer on this. But the question arises on the basis of how old the universe is. You know, is it old or is it young? I maintain there are a lot of evidences for it being young, and I hope to present some of those during the week here. But some people say the universe cannot be young, because objects are, you know, very, very far away, and it would take light a long time to travel from those objects here. Say they're a billion. Suppose you take an object that is reputed to be a billion light years from us, a light year being the distance that light travels in 1 year. Well, they would say the universe then has to be at least a billion years old, or 10 billion years, or whatever, you know, if it takes light that long to travel from that very distant object here. Well, So they claim that any arguments that one might propose that the universe is young are obviously false. Well, that's, of course, not quite correct. There are a number of, perhaps, arguments that one can propose as to why objects could be far away and still things be young, all the way from an apparent age, you see, for the universe, being created with apparent age, to this idea of Riemannian space that this gentleman has mentioned here. And I'll talk about that, since that's what the question was about. Now, this takes a minute or two, so it's not a short answer kind of question that you can sum up in 1 minute. Einstein maintained that space is curved. You see, his equations associated with his ideas of relativity would say that space is curved. But Einstein never made any statements, to my knowledge, that light traveled in any kind of curved space itself. Things happen in curved space, but I don't particularly remember a remark of that nature. You remember, back in the early 1900s, when this work on relativity was getting going good, there was a lot of argument as to whether the motion of an object affected the speed with which the light coming out of that object moved. A Swiss physicist by the name of Ritz, who proposed what's called the ballistic theory of light, he said if a star is moving, then the velocity of the light is the velocity of the light that it has in a vacuum plus the velocity of the source, you see, of the light, the velocity of the star. If the star were moving away from you, it was the velocity of that light with the velocity of the star subtracted from that. Einstein said, no, the motion of the source had nothing to do with the velocity of the light, you see, that you measured in any frame of reference. Well, Ritz died, so to speak, an untimely death, and not much was heard from him, though some people have pushed his arguments rather strongly. But an experiment or a test was proposed to decide who of these two was right about this, because, you see, Einstein, one of his basic postulates was the velocity of the source. Motion of the source or the observer had nothing to do with the speed of light that you measured in any reference frame. So a Dutch astronomer by the name of de Sitter proposed a test. He said, we can build an equation that makes a certain prediction, and in this equation, it'll come out with a certain value if Ritz is correct. This equation involved in it, the speed of light in a vacuum, the velocity of a star, the distance of the star from us in Euclidean space, the period, he picked what are called double stars, one star traveling about the other star. He applied this test to those kind of stars. This equation involved the period or the length of time it took one star to travel around another star. It involved a constant like 2 pi and a few other things, but those were the main ingredients in that formula. And on the basis of the Ritz prediction, this equation would come out with certain values, if the velocity of the source affected the velocity of the light. In other words, the equation would come out with values greater than a number 1 if the velocity of the light was affected by the motion of those stars. Or, without looking at the equation, if you took a picture of a double star, you'd get multiple images of those stars according to Ritz's prediction, if that equation came out with values greater than 1. If it were less than 1, you'd get single images of the stars. This was the test. De Sitter said, okay, we'll look at 23 stars. You looked at 23 double stars. He said, none of those double stars had multiple images. Ritz must be wrong. Einstein is right. And, of course, this is one of the early arguments that Einstein's basic assumption there was a correct assumption. Well, later on, two people, Moon and Spencer, one at MIT and the other at the University of Connecticut, they reexamined De Sitter's test, and they pointed out that De Sitter never mentioned that even though you had lacked multiple images, all of those predictions of that equation, that gamma equation I'll call it, had numbers less than 1. And on the basis of the Ritz hypothesis, you would not have had multiple images, you see. In other words, the equation that was set up predicting certain values, you know, if Ritz was correct, was such that none of those stars would fit that test, because they never gave a value of that equation greater than 1. In other words, you would not have gotten multiple images regardless of who was right in this question. So they pointed out that De Sitter had stacked the deck, so to speak. He was so convinced that he was right, and a lot of people get this way, they're so convinced they're right, he decided, well, the ends sort of justify the means in all of this. And there were no multiple images, why not just report it that way and forget about the other? Well, what they did, they took about 250 stars then. I'll try to make this long story much shorter here in a minute, so you might have time for one more question. But anyhow, They took 250 stars and calculated, you know, that gamma equation again, the values for it. And a whole slew of those stars should have had multiple images. It turned out to be a lot of those gammas greater than one. And none of them had multiple images. So it looked like Einstein won after all. After all, right triumphs over evil. And Einstein was right and Ritz was wrong and the whole thing, and that's the end of the question. But see, that's not quite it. Because what can you do in this? It could be that Einstein is right. That's a possibility, but there are other possibilities. It could have been that maybe light doesn't travel, you see, with the velocity 186,000 miles per second. Maybe it is this fellow Pecker is talking about a variation in velocity. But Moon and Spencer didn't like that idea much. They said maybe the distances are wrong for these objects that go into the equation. Well, that's certainly a possibility, because the only direct way of getting a distance is by the parallax method. And once you get past 331 light years, then all of the other methods for obtaining distances are based on assumptions, you see, that are rather difficult to prove in a number of these methods, but astronomers believe they're correct anyway. But anyhow, they didn't lie, they didn't want to bother with that one, just left that by the board. And they looked at a number of things, and they said it's possible that instead of light traveling along a straight line path or in Euclidean space, it is a possibility, since Einstein himself had proposed curved space, that light travels in a curved space rather than a Euclidean space. And perhaps if we switch this problem and recalculated the gamma factors on the basis of curved space, we might turn out that Ritz is right and Einstein is wrong in this question. So they switched to what is called Riemannian space, a curved space, in which surfaces take the shape roughly of ellipsoids of revolution. And they recalculated the whole thing, calculated the radius of curvature of that Riemannian space on the basis of what it would take, you see, to match the experimental data or the observations to bring those gammas down less than one, so you would have no multiple images. And when they did that, here's what it turned out. They found a radius of curvature for that Riemannian space of 5 light years. The radius of curvature of 5 light years, they found that as you went farther and farther and farther out in space, it took the length of time it would take light to travel from those objects approached a limiting value, or an upper limit to the length of time. You see, the conversion factor between Riemannian space and Euclidean space is a trigonometric function. And so as distance in Euclidean space becomes infinite, distance in Riemannian space measured along these Riemann surfaces approaches a limiting value, does not get infinite. And at a radius of curvature of 5 light years, if you took an object an infinite distance from us, in Riemannian space, that thing's only about 16 light years away. If the light travels, you see, along Riemann surfaces or in Riemannian space, which means that the most distant object you could think of in the universe, if you put it at an infinite distance, it would take only about 16 light years to get here in that Riemann space, instead of, you see, taking literally billions and billions of light years. Well, now, no one knows for sure how light's traveling, so it's a speculative idea, but it comes out of the work of Moon and Spencer. Maybe it's true, maybe it isn't. But I'd like to see you prove that light travels in Euclidean space. If you think it's so cut and dry to prove that, let's see you prove it. It's about as easy to go one way as the other, for that matter. So the whole question is up in the air today, and no one knows whether space is Euclidean or whether it may be curved, Riemannian space, or some kind of other space, perhaps. But it is an intriguing idea. As Mark Twain says, interesting is true, interesting anyway. Yes. Pardon? Yes, and what was his proposal? I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
What was his proposal, and is it related?
Well, Dr. Barnes is a colleague of mine. We're in the same department down at the University of Texas, El Paso. The article you're referring to in the Quarterly of the Creation Research Society is an attack that Dr. Barnes has begun against certain ideas of relativity. He is convinced that some of the basic ideas in relativity are not correct. But I don't think, and this paper has to do with that particular matter, I don't think, though, he has made any speculation as to how light travels in space. He's attacking some of the basic ideas about relativity. Dr. Barnes and I, as I say, we're colleagues, and now and then we get together.
He has an office right down the hall from me. And we go over some of these things. He's got some great ideas, and he's working on them, but right now they're sort of in the beginning stage of things. But to my knowledge, it doesn't have anything particularly to do with the way light is traveling. But it's his attack on this business of time dilation and mass changes and distance changes and so forth as a result of high speed. Yes. Well, yes, you read statements of that sort, but all they mean is that they see in a certain vicinity of space conditions they think that would give rise to the formation of stars. Say, I should mention one thing. My goodness, I should have mentioned this in my lecture. I'll throw it in right now. I should have mentioned it when talking about that entropy problem. It has to do with this formation of stars. I've taught a course in stellar astrophysics now two different times down at the university. This spring I had a course in physics of the solar system, and we were talking about the formation of the sun. I had my students take this model, you know, that has been suggested, that a star can form from a cloud of hydrogen, you know, by gravitational collapse, and make some calculations regarding it. Some years ago they had done the same problem, but a new group of students, and I thought it would be a very good problem for them to tackle, and a nice problem. I took the model that Lyman Spitzer at Princeton University has suggested. You know, a star, a cloud of hydrogen at a certain size and a certain temperature. He says it collapses gravitationally, and when it collapses, it heats up, of course. When the gas collapses, it heats up. Gravitational potential energy goes into heat energy, and the thing heats up and tends to spread back apart. But anyhow, he says it collapses down to a certain state, and he suggests the size and the temperature. Well, I had my students make the calculation, see if this was likely. Two ways. I said, calculate the entropy change, you know, as you go from state one to state two. If it is possible to happen, then the entropy ought to increase. Isn't that right? Because in all natural or spontaneous processes, entropy increases. So it should increase. So I said, calculate the entropy change, first calculation. In the second calculation, then, figure out the size of the gravitational force tending to pull all of that material together when it's there in stage one, and figure out the force that's tending, you know, due to the heating of the gas, to push it all back apart in stage one. I gave them about a month to do it in. First time I did the problem, I gave them 2 weeks. Second course, I decided to give them a month on the problem. After all, it takes a while to figure all that out. But anyhow, I gave them a month the second time, and all of the students calculated an entropy change that was negative. Now, if it's a negative entropy change, this means what? This is unlikely to occur. This is going in the wrong direction. And on the second part of the problem, they all calculated that the gravitational force was as much as 60 to 100 times smaller than the force due to the gas pressure tending to push it all apart, which means there is no way physically to get that thing to collapse, you see, and to form the nucleus of a star and to form a star. Well, this has been known for some time. Last fall, in the September 75 issue of Scientific American, A.G.W. Cameron of Columbia University talked about the origin of stars, and he said, there is no way to get a cloud to collapse to form a star. He said, it'll just come right back apart. You try to squeeze it, and it just comes back apart. So he said, here's what you have to do. He says, you have to have a cloud within a cloud. You know, you have to have another big cloud outside this little cloud. And he says, you have to have a star over here that explodes, and when it explodes, it radiates a lot of energy, and the radiation pressure, you see, the pressure of that radiation on that cloud squeezes up the outside cloud, which in turn, you see, whoops, squeezes on the inside cloud and gets your star going. Did you ever hear of anything like that? You see, in order to get a star, you've got to have what? A star. In order to get a star, you've got to have a star. And that's no explanation at all, of course, of how you could form stars. If from a star, you must always have a companion star to explode, you see. Cameron said it well. He said you can't get that cloud to collapse without something pushing on it. And he said you've got to have a supernova over here to explode, put out a lot of energy to push on that cloud. Well, there are thought to be 10 to the 22nd power number of stars in the observable universe, and you have to start out with a lot of stars to get the stars that you want.